guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is U.S. Navy veteran Jack Holder. He is also a survivor of the attack on Pearl Harbor from December 7th, 1941. And we're honored to have him here today on Veterans Chronicles. Sir, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it very much.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in a small town by the name of Gunter, G-U-N-T-E-R, 35 miles northeast of Dallas.
At what point did you join the service?
I joined the service when I could no longer stand the farming life. My father was a farmer, and I soon learned it wasn't for me. April the 24th, 1940, fresh out of high school, I joined the Navy.
Why the Navy?
Why the Navy? Well, I had seen a little literature on how to join the Navy and see the world, so it looked pretty intriguing to me.
Okay, and after you signed up, where did you go?
I signed up, boarded the train in Dallas, and headed for San Diego boot camp training.
And how did you get to Pearl Harbor?
How did I get to Pearl Harbor? December the 6th, I boarded a USS tanker loaded with 6 million gallons of fuel oil, departed for Pearl Harbor. It was quite a trip, a six-day trip. 6 million gallons, you can imagine, on a ship. We had 3 feet of freeboard. Freeboard is the distance from the top deck to the water. And I'd be the only passenger when I'm talking to one of the ship's crew. We went through a terrible storm. The captain never slowed down, and I was told by one of the ship's crew that he was a little peeved because he wanted to spend Christmas in San Diego. Any rate, I arrived at Pearl Harbor on December the 12th, 1940.
And what unit were you with now?
What unit was I with? I went immediately to PBY Squadron, VP-23. It eventually became, at that time it was VP-26, but that's the squadron I joined when I arrived.
And what does that mean, VP?
VP is a patrol, versatile patrol bomber. Aircraft built by Consolidated San Diego, PBY.
Okay, so you get there almost a year ahead of the Japanese attack.
I did.
What were you doing during that intervening time?
Well, as a young recruit in the Navy, I was far from becoming a crew member. PBY is strictly a flying boat, has no fixed landing gear. It has to have beaching gear installed on it to bring it ashore. You roll it back in the water, remove the beaching gear prior to flight. My first duties in the Navy was 4 months in the beach crew.
Okay, and that's the first 4 months, then what?
After 4 months, I was assigned to a PBY crew as a waste hatch gunner and a first mechanic. After that 4 months, I rose to the rank of plane captain, which the plane captain in the Navy is another word for flight engineer. The only difference is in the Navy, you fly the same airplane all the time, and the plane captain or the flight engineer is responsible for every aspect of airworthiness on an aircraft. In other words, the bombardier, the radio man, every enlisted man is a five-man enlisted crew, and those gentlemen report to the plane captain. The plane captain reports to the pilot.
Prior to the attack, was there a lot of anxiety about there being a war in the Pacific theater? Or?
No one ever thought about it. No one even heard about it. They never dreamed it would happen. In fact, I've been told that many influential people were interviewed, questioned on this prior to this, and they were asked a question, do you think Japan would attack the U.S.? And their answer was they'd never be that foolish. For many years, at that time, Admiral Kimmel was our commander of the Pacific Fleet. For many years, I blamed him, but I later learned that he didn't know more about it than I did.
So describe your day. Well, how did December 7th begin for you?
Well, as an enlisted man, you have four sections in there and in the squadron, and every fourth day you have the duty, which means you stay aboard and stand watch. You cannot go ashore. I happened to have the duty that day. We had just fell in for muster. We were lined up in our hangar when the section leader began roll call. we heard a screaming aircraft, and moments later, a terrible explosion. We ran outside the hangar, and the hangar beside us, VP-21, had received the first bomb that fell on Ford Island, about 100 yards from me. It was engulfed in smoke and flame, and it so happened that our aircraft, our PBYs, were parked between the two hangars. The bomb was close enough that most of our aircraft were damaged. The squadron is 12 aircraft. Most of them were damaged, but these aircraft were only 2 weeks old. We had just returned from San Diego with them, brand new aircraft.
And so what was the response after that?
It so happened that one of my shipmates remembered, and incidentally when we ran out, the first thing we seen was a circling aircraft overhead with the rising sun insignia. We immediately knew what happened, and everything goes through your mind. I've been asked so many times, what were your thoughts at that time? But you have so many, it's hard to describe, I guess. Fear, anger, surprise, whatever, you know. But when we seen the rising sun on insignia on the aircraft, we knew immediately what had happened. It so happened that one of my shipmates remembered there was a sewer line behind our hangar under construction. He says, let's go for the ditch, follow me. We all ran, jumped in the ditch, sat there clinging to each other. One of the aircraft seen us, circled, strafed the ditch, hit the dirt piled up beside the ditch, missing us probably 3 feet. I'm not sure how long we were in the ditch, but as I sat there, I've been asked, you know, what my thoughts were at that time, and I guess my most vivid memory is, God, please don't let me die in this ditch. This was a two-wave attack, of course. You know, the first wave was 187 aircraft, dive bombers, torpedo planes, and fighters. And the second wave arrived an hour and 15 minutes later, 167 aircraft, the same type of aircraft, and struck the same targets. I don't know how long we were in the ditch, but as soon as we got up, but prior to the second wave, I seen all the ships up, battleship were on fire, the Arizona, the West Virginia, the Tennessee, Nevada, Oklahoma, California. It was a devastating sight I'll never forget. The captains of our squadron's aircraft was in the hangar undergoing a 30-hour check, and I was directed along with two other sailors to help get the aircraft ready for flight. On the mechanical side of it, we installed new spark plugs, buttoned up the engines. The aircraft was rolled out, refueled, loaded with two 1,000-pound bombs. The captain and his crew flew for 19 hours looking for the Japanese forces, but found nothing.
So then what was the priority?
As soon as this happened, of course, martial law was declared. Of course, a complete blackout all over the Hawaiian Islands. And late in the afternoon, incidentally, part of this, after the first wave hit, we had construction crews. The Oklahoma, battleship Oklahoma had turned turtle up. The keel of the ship was up. We had construction crews out there on the bottom of the ship, cutting holes in the bottom of the ship, rescuing seamen trapped inside. But what I started to say was, later in the afternoon, machine gun pits constructed from sandbags were set up all around Ford Island. I had the good fortune, along with two other seamen, to man one of these pits for 3 days and nights, dining on bologna sandwiches, drinking coffee, and fighting mosquitoes. We had no idea where the Japanese forces were or if they were coming back, but every aircraft or every ship noise we heard, we thought they were. Fortunately, that didn't happen. On the fourth day, we were allowed to return to our barracks. All lockers had been broken open to retrieve white clothing for bandages. And at that time, we were issued a postcard with two inscribed inscriptions. The first one read, I've been wounded. The second one said, I am okay, don't worry. My mother received this card 11 days later.
Jack, we'll pause right there. We'll take a quick break and come back and continue your story on Veterans Chronicles. We're back. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. I'm joined today by U.S. Navy veteran Jack Holder, also a survivor of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And sir, when we left off, you were talking about the notice your mother got 11 days after the fact that you had survived the attack. Was there much correspondence soon between you and your parents?
Not at all.
Not at all?
No. I don't remember how long it was, but it was quite a while, you know, before I was allowed to correspond at all.
So once we've taken stock of exactly what the Japanese have inflicted here, what is your unit specifically doing?
Well, everything returned to normal. Training, patrolling, the main duties of the PBY out there was search and rescue and patrol. We returned to our normal duties of patrol around the Hawaiian Islands. Immediately after the war started, President Roosevelt called his military staff together and he says, I want you to devise a plan to bomb Tokyo. He was advised as well, it's impossible, Mr. President. We don't have any aircraft with that capability. He managed to get up out of his wheelchair and he says, don't tell me, it's impossible. They came up with the plan, which entailed Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. He was told to put together a group of capable flyers and start training in the B-25 on very short field takeoffs and landings. He lined up a group of men. He says, men, we're going on a mission. I cannot tell you what the mission is, but we're going on a mission from which you probably won't return. If you still like to go, please step forward. Every man did. On April 2nd, after completion of training, they were moved aboard the USS Hornet and were then told that their mission was to bomb Tokyo. April 18th, en route to Tokyo, but 650 miles from Tokyo, and also to 250 miles short of their planned launch point, the Enterprise and the Hornet was spotted by a Japanese fishing vessel. Admiral Halsey said, well, I know our position has been reported. He turned both ships into the wind and the flank speed, launched 16 B-25s. They all reached their target, dropped their bombs, but due to their early launch, trying to reach their destinations in China, several crashed. One gentleman died when he bailed out of the aircraft. Two died in the crash. Eight were captured. Three were executed. Immediately after the raid, naval intelligence began receiving messages using coded messages using the letters AF and AO. We had broken the Japanese code to a point they knew what the letters meant, but they could not ascertain which one. They knew that one meant the Aleutian Islands, the other Midway, but they couldn't tell which one. Chief of Intelligence told Admiral Nimitz, he says, I've devised a plan to find out what they mean. He says, we'll send out an uncoded message saying Midway has just had a freshwater condenser failure. The Japanese took the bait. They sent out a coded message saying AF has just had a freshwater condenser failure. We then knew what they meant, but they still did not know if their intention was to hit Midway or the Aleutians. Nimitz thought that he believed it would be Midway. Washington was not convinced. They sent a courier out to talk to Nimitz and says, what if you're wrong? He says, did the Washington send you out here to tell me not to go to Midway? The courier said, no. He says, then you return to Washington. He then sent a small task force to the Aleutian in disguise and sent the rest of the task force to Midway. He positioned the carriers in one location, rest of the fleet in another. And May the 26th, my squadron and two others were on the way to Midway, began our search for the Japanese fleet. We found them 450 miles from Midway. And I happened to be in the second aircraft to spot this armada approaching Midway. June the 4th, they hit. At that time, the Marines were equipped with an obsolete aircraft, the Brewster Buffalo. They sent 27 of them aloft. Only 7 of them returned, and they were badly damaged. In addition, our torpedo fleet was completely annihilated. The Hornet launched 30 torpedo planes. Only 1 man returned. They then launched 15 more, and only 4 of those returned. 45 aircraft, we lost 40. But this is the time when the tide was about to turn. We had airborne 3 squadrons of Douglas dive bombers. They'd been airborne 2 hours, searching for the Japanese fleet, running low on fuel. But the commander, Lieutenant Commander Wade McCluskey, says, "We're going to press on just a little longer." And just moments later, he spotted the white wake of a fast-moving Japanese destroyer, and he says, "That ship has to be racing to rejoin the main fleet. We'll follow it." And just moments again, they found 3 aircraft carriers diving from 20,000 feet. They sunk 3 aircraft carriers in 4 minutes. They were aided by 2 factors. Admiral Nagumo, the commander of the Japanese carrier force, had received word that damage to Midway was slight. He says, "We'll rearm with bombs and return to Midway." Yamamoto says, "No, we'll rearm with torpedoes and go after their fleet." While they were rearming, and also their fighter aircraft at that time was defending their own aircraft against our torpedo planes, that's when our dive bomber struck.
Sir, let me pause you right there. We'll pick up your story in just a second. We're back on Veterans Chronicles. Honored to be joined today at the American Veterans Center Conference by U.S. Navy veteran Jack Holder. He's been telling us not only his experiences at Pearl Harbor, but he's also been giving us a very fascinating and detailed explanation of the Battle of Midway. And, sir, you were just talking about the torpedo bombers and dive bombers.
A little later in the day, after the 3 aircraft were sunk, Admiral Spruance called Admiral Nimitz and says, "We've had a good day, Admiral. We sunk 3 aircraft carriers. Do you think that's enough?" He said, "Hell no. I want the 4th one." The Hiryu, which was still there, was found later and sunk. They come to Midway with 4 aircraft carriers and left with none. It so happened that I was airborne at 4 o'clock that morning, armed with four 500-pound bombs. Early afternoon, we found a submarine surfaced, unmanned. All hatches were closed. We dropped the first bomb on the fantail, made another run, dropped another 500-pounder behind a conning tower, and we made 6 circles around it, watching all kind of debris surface. We assumed we sunk the sub. Later in the afternoon, we had lost all contact with Midway. We did not know if we still controlled it or the Japanese had it. We had a decision to make. We could take a chance on returning to Midway, or we could drop our remaining bombs and set down at sea. We dropped our 2 remaining bombs unarmed, set down at sea, threw out a sea anchor, and drifted all night. I took a sleeping bag, climbed on top of the wing, tied myself to an antenna, and spent the evening. Sun up the next morning, we finally made contact with Midway. We learned that we had been successful. We're also told that there was a destroyer at the French frigate Shoals loaded with aviation fuel. We took sun sights, found our position, flew to the Shoals, refueled, went back to Midway.
That's about as successful as you can possibly be. A lot of successful targeting of the Japanese there.
We did, yeah. When we returned to Pearl Harbor, we were greeted by Admiral Nimitz and he shook hands with everybody, and it was quite a homecoming. However, it was short-lived. We had 5 days of glorious pleasure at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, but on July the 1st, I was in Noumea, New Caledonia, where I started patrol of Guadalcanal and all the Solomon Islands.
And what did that entail?
I flew 48 missions over the Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands, 7 month period.
And what kind of engagement, if any, did you have?
We had many engagements. We did not sink any submarines or anything, but our duties in the PBOI, search and patrol and anti-submarine patrol, we did all that. We reported Japanese shipping. We acted as an intelligent crew.
And who did you report to?
We reported back to the home base.
How much recon could you do? Was it easy to collect information?
PBY?
Yeah.
Well, it was originally built for search and rescue, but after the war started, it was used for everything. Torpedo runs, bombing runs, what have you.
That was obviously one of the more intense battles of the Pacific Theater.
It was. We returned every day, most every day, with bullet holes in the aircraft. Sometimes returned on one engine. It was pretty gruesome.
How often did you have to fire at them?
Well, not every day you were there, but I would say probably 20% of the flights.
Did you feel like you were at an advantage or a disadvantage in your planes in those situations?
Well, depending on how you were attacked and so forth, or how many enemy planes they were. But a lot of times in a PBY, you had 250 caliber machine guns in the tail with inside a blister. A lot of times, if an enemy aircraft was approaching, if they seen that blister go up, they'd pull away. They weren't all that brave all the time.
I've also read that you were at the Battle of the Coral Sea. Is that correct? After Guadalcanal, where were you?
I'd like to interject one, few more thoughts on Guadalcanal.
Oh, sure.
When I first went there, the commanding officer was Admiral Gormley. He was known to be a very smart admiral, but he didn't seem to be getting the job done. He had been there for 2 or 3 months. In fact, in my first 2 months there, we were definitely losing the battle in Guadalcanal. He even sent a communique to Admiral Nimitz saying, "My forces are inadequate. I can no longer control the situation." He was immediately relieved by Admiral Bull Halsey. Halsey took command. He come and visited all of the PBY flight crews. He then went aboard the island, visited every unit on the island. He says, "We will no longer allow the enemy to call the shots." He says, "We'll kill every son of a bitch on this island, and I'll be right there with you." Things begin to turn. February of 1943, I received orders to travel to San Diego, supposedly to help commission a new PBY squadron and return to the Pacific. When I reached there, my orders had been changed. I started training in the B-24, spent 2 months San Diego, moved to Argentia, Newfoundland for additional 2 months. I was then sent to Dunkswell, Devonshire, England, spent 15 months in Dunkswell, flew 56 missions in the B-24 over the English Channel and the Bay of Biscay, which is the western coast of France.
Were you surprised that you were sent to the European theater?
Yeah, very much. There's very few people that participated in both theaters. It so happened that before our arrival, the channel, full of German subs, of course, was patrolled with PBYs, but they figured they needed more gunpowder. We had 5 squadrons of Navy B-24s at Winston Dunkswell. We flew 657 missions over the channel, sunk 8 submarines, and damaged 4 more.
It's a very different mindset, I'm guessing, between the two different
Completely different. Completely different aircraft, completely different. Incidentally, while we were there, enlisted men in the B-24 had to wear a Royal Air Force uniform with an American flag sewn on the left sleeve, the chambray shirt, and dungarees worn by an enlisted man in the Navy was not recognized as a uniform. If we'd been captured, we could have been shot as a spy.
Which did you prefer, the PBYs or the bombers?
Oh, the B-24.
Yeah.
PBY is a great airplane, but you're talking about a completely different aircraft there.
Talk about your crew. What kind of crew did you have?
I had a great crew. In the Navy, this was an 11-man crew, three officers and eight enlisted men.
And then on the bombers?
You had the pilot, co-pilot, navigator, two radio men, bombardier, plane captain, two waist hatch gunners, a tail gunner, and a tunnel gunner.
What's the most harrowing experience you had with the B-24? Because those were targeted pretty heavily.
Well, we could go on here for several hours on that. The B-24, I was not only the plane captain, the flight engineer, but I was also the top turret gunner. In the patrol over the channel, a lot of cloud cover, of course, but we encountered many Messerschmitt 109s, German fighter. You could dive into a cloud to get out of, to avoid the attack or something, but a lot of times when you come out the other side, a fighter will be on the other side waiting for you. It so happened, one time when we done it, when we come out the other side, there was a Mimi 109 passing right in front of us. All I had to do was squeeze both triggers. I didn't even have to move the gun turret. Was a joyous feeling.
What's that like when you do it for real?
Well, you know it's either you or him, so it's quite exciting.
You stayed in Europe for the remainder of the war?
No, I stayed there until late June 1945. Was transferred to Chincoteague, Virginia to help commission a new B-24 squadron. The war was dwindling down a little at that time. The squadron was never commissioned. I spent a year there as plane captain. Was transferred to Pensacola, Florida, to PB-4Y2 squadron, which is the Navy's version of the B-24. And different, it had a larger engine, had a single tail, a little longer range and so forth, but this aircraft never seen much action. I spent a year there just as plane captain, but did not go back into conflict anymore. My last year then, I was transferred to Patuxent River, Maryland. I was plane captain on what the Navy called the R-5D, and civilian life was the DC-4, Douglas DC-4.
Just a couple minutes left in our conversation, Mr. Holder, and I just want to get some big picture thoughts from you, because obviously you've been a witness to history and a participant in history. First, Pearl Harbor. What do you think of most when you think of what happened that day and the impact it had on you and our nation?
Well, you know, as I reiterated earlier, for years I blamed Admiral Kimmel, but I now know that was not true. But we had 5 listening stations set up around the world. 2 in San Francisco, 1 in Seattle, 1 on Wake Island, 1 in the Philippines. FDR and Admiral Stark were briefed every morning on the position of the Japanese fleet. They knew exactly where they were. It's now thought that President Roosevelt wanted this to happen so we could join the British in the fight for their own kingdom. And even though we lost all those lives, it might have been a blessing in disguise. So what would have happened if we had allowed Hitler to take over England? That's my thoughts on it.
Would have been a very different world.
Yes, it would.
For sure.
We could either be speaking German or Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Without question. When you think of other things that you were part of, Midway, Guadalcanal, and the European theater, what comes to mind first? What are you most proud of?
Well, after Pearl Harbor, you know, there was so much resentment, so much anger and so forth, and understanding, you know, misunderstanding, I guess. But when we turned the tide in Midway, it was a relief. It was a great pleasure. And it's gone down in history now as one of the greatest naval battles of all time. Admiral Halsey said if we had lost Midway, It would have prolonged the war by many months. If we'd lost Midway and Guadalcanal, we could possibly have lost the war.
So to know that you had a role in those absolutely critical battles.
I'm very happy about that. I'm very happy that I'm still here to talk about it, but I'm glad that I played a small part.
How important is it to you to tell your story and to make sure that people of all generations understand the price of freedom?
Until about 5 or 6 years ago, I never even told my golfing buddies that I was a World War II veteran. I met a young lady who started asking me a lot of questions about my military, and she says, "You've got to come out of the closet. You've got to start talking to people." I immediately then was greeted with a trip by the Arizona Honor Flight 2 to a trip to Washington, D.C. We made a stop in Detroit, and there was a long throng of people, 200 yards long, lined up on the tarmac greeting our plane when we taxied in. I then began to realize there were people out there that were interested and still cared. So it changed my whole aspect of everything. Since then, I've given so many presentations you wouldn't believe. I went to back to Pearl Harbor on 2014 greeted by the Greatest Generation Foundation. And the gentleman that put up the money for our trip out there was a gentleman by the name of John Riesig, the president of Chives in Austin, Texas. He rode with me in the parade in Honolulu. And he says, "When we get back, I want you and your fiance to come to Austin to visit me." We went down. We had a podcast there that he had, and he had the governor of Texas there, Rick Perry, who sat in on the podcast. When I returned, I received an email from the governor's aide, said they wanted me in Dallas on stage with the governor when he announced his candidacy for president. I was there. And another industry, Matthew Apparels, which is a highly respected manufacturer of sports clothing in Huntington Beach, California, had seen the podcast in Texas. He sent me 6 beautiful golf shirts. I called him to thank him. He invited me to Huntington Beach to do a presentation there. So I've given presentations all over the country.
Well, we thank you for coming to Washington and to the conference, and we thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us here on Veterans Chronicles.
I certainly appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Jack Holder is a veteran of the U.S. Navy, survivor of Pearl Harbor, and of both the Pacific and European theaters in World War II. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Veterans Chronicles. Hi, this is Greg Corumbus, and thanks for listening to Veterans Chronicles, a presentation of the American Veterans Center. For more information, please visit AmericanVeteransCenter.org. You can also follow the American Veterans Center on Facebook and on Twitter, we're at @AVCUpdate. Subscribe to the American Veterans Center YouTube channel for full oral histories and special features. And of course, please subscribe to the Veterans Chronicles podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and please join us next time for Veterans Chronicles.